Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Opinions expressed on the First Coast Connect Week in Review are those of our panelists and do not reflect the views of WJCT News 89.9.
Good morning, I'm Ann Schindler, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our First Coast Week in Review. Today, our panel of journalists is discussing the cost and controversy of new Duval County School Superintendent and continuing conversations over possible school closures. We're going to be talking about the sentencing of a former teacher today. He pleaded guilty to sexual misconduct with a student. We're going to be talking about community upset over the approval of an Ocean Way Chick-fil-A. We're also going to be talking about the city's last place rankings by Forbes magazine as a summer vacation destination. To talk about all that and more, I'm joined by Charlie McGee, poverty reporter for the online investigative newsroom, The Tributary. Hi, Charlie.
Ann.
Megan Malicote, education reporter at Jacksonville Today. Hi, Megan.
Good morning, Ann.
Welcome back. Ann Maxwell, investigative reporter at News for Jax.
Good morning, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Hi, Ann Maxwell. And Will Brown, race, inequality, and poverty reporter for Jacksonville Today. Thanks so much to all of you for being here. Let's start with Duval's new superintendent. The big deal, it's been a year, a couple of attempts to hire this gentleman. Megan, catch us up on what is happening with the hiring decision this week.
Yes, so the board voted to approve Christopher Bernier's contract this week. It was the end of a year-long search, and the contract offers him $320,000 as a base pay per year. Plus a number of incentives, but not the incentives that he had asked for. So there's no money to pay a mentor, for instance. The retirement contribution is a little less, the things like that. So when the board approved his contract, they voted 6-1. Warren Jones was the only board member who did not vote in favor of the contract because he felt the pay was too high. But all of the board members are happy with their choice. And are looking forward to Dr. Bernier starting.
Yeah, and this is happening despite the fact that there have been some concerns, at least in the community, people asking for a restart of this effort because of a whistleblower complaint at his old district and a couple of pending federal lawsuits.
That's right. In our reporting, we did turn up a whistleblower complaint and some existing lawsuits. However, I spoke with Chair Willie this week, and he assured me that the board has done their due diligence to research Dr. Bernier fully, that they called the people that he asked, that he provided numbers to call, and that they have researched him to a point where they feel very confident in their choice and they're not concerned about the ongoing issues.
Yeah. And Ann Maxwell, what have we heard directly from Dr. Bernier at this point in terms of responding to concerns or the whistleblower complaint allegations?
He said he doesn't believe there's any factual basis to the whistleblower complaint. School board member Warren Jones said he reached out to the assistant superintendent, I believe, down in Lee County in Southwest Florida, where Dr. Bernier had been the superintendent and where the complaint was filed against him. He said that they said there was no truth to it as well, and they're not, the board, based on their investigation, isn't worried about it. There's also two lawsuits alleging racism within the school district about an incident on a baseball team at a high school there. And the superintendent was named in the suit, which is common as, you know, a defendant to include their name in it. But it wasn't an incident he was directly involved in based on what the suit is saying.
Mm-hmm. Daryl Willie is the chair. He's one of a couple of African-American board members. How important, Will, was it that he supported Dr. Bernier through this and, you know, was a vocal advocate for bringing him on?
Well, the chair is the person in the school district who, excuse me, on the school board who speaks for the whole board. They have like a unofficial policy of the chair is the person who speaks for the board. So he was essentially the one taking all the public arrows and the questions about Dr. Bernier. I would say he probably wouldn't be any more or less important than any other member. He's the chair at this moment. The most recent chair when Dr. Diana Green left or retired was Dr. Kelly Coker. And she was the one who was taking all those questions at the same time. So just observing the board, who the chair is, doesn't really matter all that much. They're just the person who's taking all the questions.
So there is a lot on his plate, Charlie, now that he takes the reins, I guess, July 1, but already has been attending community meetings about these proposed school closures. That's going to be a real dominant job for him. It's quite a lot for a new superintendent coming into a district to be making those kinds of decisions right from the jump.
Right. I mean, I think as someone who's sort of observed from the outside, not directly reported, I think I've seen it's somewhere around 30 school closures are potentially on the table out of 155 total schools. I mean, that's a pretty large number. It's about almost 20% of the schools. And, you know, I know they're forming a whole bunch of sort of focus groups to assess this. They'll have one that's sort of a magnet school focused group, and then 11 others that are focused on different public school interests and ideas. So, I mean, it seems to be a very open-ended question right now of where the district's going to be in a year, 2 years. And so, you know, Superintendent Bernier is going to have a huge task on his plate.
Yeah, I believe, Megan, that they've said that there isn't really a single school, you know, feeder district that would not be impacted by some of these school closures.
I think that's true, that they have a list of they're looking at lots of schools from all the feeder patterns right now in the during the community meetings that they've had this week and will continue to have next week. They're asking for feedback from parents and community members from each feeder pattern just to tell the board why their school is special, right? Why their school doesn't need to be closed. Mm-hmm. So they want to know what's unique about each school.
Well, if you're just joining us, we are hearing from reporters Ann Maxwell, Will Brown, Megan Malicote, and Charlie McGee about the week's biggest headlines. You can join our conversation at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can also watch our live stream right now on Facebook and YouTube. We have a call from Charles on the West Side. Good morning, Charles. Go ahead.
Good morning, All Stars. I wanted to ask you if the school board would have gone ahead with using the actual national search committee to get a new school, to get a new superintendent, we could have avoided some of these issues that are popping up now. It seems like every time we have a search committee, their searches are never completed or disregarded. And speaking on the Chick-fil-A, just real quick, geez, the city council has been overturning the people's will in all these neighborhoods like San Marco with the storage units, now the Chick-fil-A, and goodness, there must be two others going on right now where the residents are trying to stop something. And so it's important, folks, that other listeners out there, watch what you do at the ballot box because, you know, it matters. And thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, Charles. Appreciate your input. We will get to the discussion of the Chick-fil-A in just a minute, but I want to stick with schools for just a little bit. There is a sentencing hearing today, and in the case of Jeffrey Clayton, he's the former chair of the vocal department at Douglas Anderson School of the Arts. He was actually arrested on campus a couple of years ago.
Last March.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and so he's facing he's pleaded guilty to four felonies involving grooming and touching a 16-year-old student. He was 65 at the time. He'd been at the school for 20-plus years, I believe. So he's facing between fewer than 3 years in prison and up to nearly 40 years in prison. And that sentencing hearing is at 1:30 this afternoon.
And what are we expecting to hear at a sentencing hearing like this?
So as part of the plea deal, the state has agreed not to bring any additional charges against Clayton related to his time at Douglas Anderson, and seven additional female former students were going to be allowed to testify at the sentencing, presumably, you know, potential victims or people who would support kind of the state side of things. And so I have heard from the state attorney's office yesterday, three of those are going to be testifying tomorrow is how it ended up shaking up, as well as the victim in the case for the charges being brought. And we're also going to hear a controlled phone call with Clayton where everything's laid out. So I've been told to,
explain to us what a control call is.
Brace for it. So this is a recorded phone call where the police listen in to try to catch somebody admitting they've done a crime.
And this is a call between Jeffrey Clayton and his student?
I believe so.
Right. we presumably will also hear from some people who support Jeffrey Clayton, who want to speak on his behalf.
Right.
And he's also submitted a motion, a sentencing memorandum, I guess, his attorney, that lays out some defenses and some arguments as to why he shouldn't be given the maximum or he should be given a lesser sentence.
Right. So they're arguing, you know, for the minimum sentence, and they say he's never been committed he's never committed a crime, no criminal history. He's done everything right on bail. And an interesting part of it is there's a list of dozens of former students identified just by their initials and, you know, a little blurb about what they've done in their career that's been a success, that Clayton is saying, you know, I've done all these good things for all these other students. And then some of them found out about it and were really upset and said they didn't have permission to do that. And, you know, Clayton's attorney says the sentencing memo doesn't say in any way that they support him or what he's done. And we ended up redacting it, you know, out of respect for them. But so that caused some people to be upset as well.
So you've heard from some of these former students who are not happy that they're being used as an example of how great a teacher he was.
I've heard from one of them, and then sources have told me about others as well. And yeah.
Will, one thing that's interesting about the sentencing memorandum is that it lays out, you know, other cases as examples of sentences that, you know, Jeffrey Clayton's attorneys believe are more appropriate. And I found it really interesting looking through that list. They talk about the case, the defendant, what they were accused of doing, and the sentence that they got. And most of these, you know, sort of lower sentences were cases involving women, where the woman was the accused predator, the woman was the convicted teacher in this case, which I think maybe just speaks to the, you know, how we skew somewhat in our thinking about sexual predation, you know, who is doing it.
Predators should be judged equally. It's just some of the things about reading about this case are unfathomable, especially as someone who has a child in the Duval County public school system.
You mean yourself?
No. Yes. I have a child in the Duval County public school system. He is not a student at Douglas Anderson, but it is just, as a parent, it is very hard to just even read some of the accusations. Like Ann, I've spoken with former DA students and survivors, and even someone who was a student of Clayton's, and they told me that they hope that he gets the absolute maximum sentence today. I think he faces up to 33.6 years, which for someone of his age is an essential life sentence. There isn't anybody in the Florida state prison system. There aren't too many people in their 90s in the Florida state prison system. So it will be interesting to see what the judge does, but there are going to be a lot of emotions in the courtroom today.
To be clear, he was not accused of, you know, having any actual, like, you know, actually having sex with a student. There was some touching, there was some kissing, but I think one of the comparisons that his attorneys draw is that there's many, many worse cases that went much farther between teachers and students, Megan. But this memo also, you know, pushes off some of the responsibility in this particular case where Jeffrey Clayton says, you know, they were both looking forward to these encounters, that he described it as something of a reciprocal nature, that they both wanted it to continue. And again, we're talking about a 16-year-old.
But yes, I think that's the important part to remember, is that his position of power in a student's age.
And Will, Charlie, this is, you know, there have been complaints that we understand dating way back in this case. It's actually somewhat responsible, we believe, for the departure of the former superintendent. So this has been a really consequential case for the school district.
Yeah. And, you know, something interesting to me is, you know, we very recently had a Florida state senator publicly call for the district to release the findings of an internal investigation that they did with, I believe, the city of Jacksonville's Office of the Inspector General, sort of a joint investigation. And there's a full report out there, I mean, or internally that exists, but it hasn't been made public. And this state senator was basically saying, hey, release this. Like, the public wants to know. They want answers to this question. And from the responses, the sort of public response I've seen thus far from the district, they sort of implicitly are declining to do that, you know, not, you know, basically not saying that they're going to release the report, which I think is an interesting
I mean, presumably it's a public record.
Presumably. But the board, said that they would have released this by now. They when they started this investigation, I want to say in April or May of last year, they said that the report was going, they were going to share their findings with the public. They said that they were going to have this out, look to have this available by the time they had the new superintendent in place. Well, we have a new superintendent. The board members have been told of what's in this report. We, the public, have not. Mm. Why?
Ann Maxwell, what are your thoughts about the availability of that report, whether that is something that will ultimately be disclosed, be required to be disclosed as a public record?
I think one complicating factor is that the school district has been sued about Jeffrey Clayton. It's a Title IX federal lawsuit saying this student was sexually harassed by Clayton and they had complaints about him and they didn't do anything. So I think they might be using that to sit on it for now, saying there's ongoing litigation. But presumably at some point, once that wraps up, at the very least, it should be available.
Unfortunately, you've done extensive reporting on this issue, you know, in a bigger space, because there were many accusations against many, many teachers at that school over a long period of time.
That's right. And what we've heard is it was just a very toxic culture. And while they have this excellent arts program that's really done well for a lot of these students, there were these, it was kind of looked the other way when a teacher was inappropriate, is what sources have told me, because they were getting all this money from donors and wanted the school to have a good reputation. And so when there were complaints, they wouldn't really be addressed or would be brushed under the rug because they didn't want to ding their fundraising, which is a sad thing to hear, which the former principal has denied, Jackie Cornelius, I should say.
We have a call from Robin in Riverside Avondale. Good morning, Robin. Go ahead.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, great, 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 great. I am a volunteer and a grandmother she will be now in first grade. Molly is going to Fishwater Elementary. And I just really wanted some help understanding how the schools can be helped to stay there. I think the official term is individually evaluated. Fishwater's been there, gosh, I think 100 years, but it's been a magnet school for many, many years. It's just terrific. My daughter and son-in-law, literally, when they got married 13 years ago, they moved to that part of Jacksonville. So if they had children, they could go to Fishwater. Mm. And I've been volunteering two mornings a week for the whole last school year. And that school is just terrific. And I just can't imagine it being shut down. And it has a long waiting list of kids to get in. Right. So how do you make a school that is on that list, how do you individually evaluate it so they can stay open, is my question.
Thanks, Robin, and thanks for the volunteer work that you do. Megan, I mean, a lot of parents and a lot of grandparents are very concerned about these school closures, and I think they're really not sure what to do.
I think that's true. What I've heard from the board so far is that the list of schools that's been publicized so far, the 37 or however many schools it is that are considered to be considered for being closed, are based completely on factors that don't take into account the school's personality, let's say. So it's things like the age of the building and the enrollment and things like that. But the board right now in those community meetings is asking for feedback about the school. So the type of feedback that you just said. And that hopefully will factor into their decisions about which schools to keep and then which schools to close. So I would say that the board is asking for feedback on their website, too, and you can go and give feedback about individual schools that you care about.
But it's also worth noting that while they're asking for that feedback, the board has to be even more proactive about hearing the perspective of the entire community, because they are so, the folks who are showing up to these meetings are people who have the time and resources to spend 2-3 hours at a community meeting all across town, whereas there are other people. For example, there was a community conversation held at the school board headquarters, because that's for people who live in District 3 of the school board. Well, there are a lot of people who speak Spanish as their only language who live in District 3. They probably were not able to get to the school board headquarters at 6 o'clock in the middle of the week. What is the school board doing? What is the district doing to make sure those parents are heard? Same thing for some parents out way out on the west side, way out super north side, northwest Jacksonville, the same thing. They really have to be, because I spoke with one person this week who she will go to these meetings and then she will physically go to areas like 45th and Moncrief, College, Magnolia Gardens, Grand Park, and kind of doing each one, teach one of what she's learning, she's sharing with other people. It's because she said it's not that they aren't interested. They just might have multiple jobs and might not have the opportunity to spend all that kind of time at a school board function.
Charlie, the kind of reporting that you do, I mean, we look at a list of 30 schools. I think that there's, you know, in everyone's mind, the sense, the concern that that would end up falling disproportionately on communities that are under-resourced, communities of color.
Yeah. No, and I mean, you have to always keep in mind the potential of politics getting involved, you know, at who maybe has the resources potentially to contribute, you know, resources, money to try and protect a, you know, a certain district or area that maybe is in their interest, and, you know, who doesn't have those resources. Obviously, it's impoverished communities, you know, that it's a lot less influence there at the power structure, and with all these different perspectives that are being gathered at once, you have to wonder how effectively is the district going to be able to juggle all of that input rather than maybe ultimately just deciding to, you know, go with, you know, what sort of they've been swayed one way or the other to decide on.
But to Charlie's point, four of the seven seats on the school board are up for election this year. So people have a chance to vote for the people that they want to make decisions about how they want this to go. There are two races that do not have an incumbent. There might be another. We'll find out in a couple days. So if people want to dictate how the school board makes these decisions on which schools to close, you have a chance at the polls in August.
And
before the decision will be made this fall.
I think qualifying ends today, if I'm not mistaken. So we should know how those races are shaking out. We've got a call from Cynthia in Ortega. Good morning, Cynthia. Go ahead.
Good morning. I guess I better turn your radio off so that you can hear me. I am concerned. I went to one of the meetings last night. I would like to ask you.
Hey, Cynthia, I'm going to need you to turn that radio down if you're going to continue.
Okay. I wanted to ask if there is any way that you could have the members of the school board come on your program and address the basis and the criteria upon which they're making their decisions. What I discerned from that meeting last night that I went to was that there is very little concern about how this affects children and their families. It is all about the budget and how much money they have to spend. And they have spent an enormous amount of money, evidently, getting outside consultation on this. But there's no focus on how this is affecting children and their families. And I think that we should ask the school board members to resign if they're not concerned about the children and the families. What they are asking to do is to dismantle a substantial amount of a public school system. And a good, strong public school system is so important for our community's growth and continued development.
Thank you, Cynthia. Thank you for your comments. There are a lot of discussions right now happening, Megan, about, you know, this being the natural result of some state level policies, particularly where funds are directed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and so this is something I think when it comes to, it's not just about local races that we're going to be having people ask those questions, but also at the state level where a lot of those decisions are actually made.
Yes, that's true. The state funding does impact our district's ability to provide the public school system.
Yeah. All right. Well, I want to move on to talk about this very controversial fast food restaurant that is going into the Ocean Way neighborhood. It's a Chick-fil-A. there are hundreds and hundreds of people that are upset about this because basically the drive-through entrance, the entrance to the restaurant is going to actually be within the entrance to their subdivision. So Will, one of our callers earlier raised this question. It does seem that there have been a couple of really high profile instances recently where city council has gone against the will of the residents. You mentioned the San Marcos storage facility. That's obviously a big one. What deference is given to the community on these really, you know, controversial decisions where there's a lot of community opposition?
Clearly none. But I mean, to be serious, it was a 12-7 vote, and I was looking at the people who voted against this proposal. Most of them were district council members, and most of them were district council members who have found their way up to and near and around First Coast High School and this neighborhood where this Chick-fil-A will be located. I've seen them at events at First Coast, or other people, they've been around the neighborhood, so they know what a Chick-fil-A right across the street from a high school with an entrance in a neighborhood, what that would do to traffic.
This was originally zoned for a McDonald's in 2008, Charlie, and I think a lot of people point to that as, you know, it's not new. We always knew this was going to be a fast food restaurant. But to be fair, the development really wasn't even built out at that point. There, you know, that was still kind of under construction. So I would imagine there's a number of people that moved in and bought without any understanding of the potential.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think it's a vacant lot still to this day. And, you know, I think maybe a year or so ago, there was already an initial attempt to get approval to build a Chick-fil-A here, and that had been rejected by the council. And so it's interesting that essentially the same idea, the same proposal is being brought by the developer again just a year later. You have to wonder if he maybe feels that the new council, the council that's currently in office, is maybe more amenable to the idea than the prior council was. I'm unsure, but I mean, it is an important point to emphasize Chick-fil-A in specific. I mean, the traffic at this seems to just be a universal thing with Chick-fil-A. I mean, I love Chick-fil-A, right? But like every time you go through the drive-through, it's significantly more congested than, say, a McDonald's, most McDonald's you go to. And so
it's kind of a perpetual line.
Right. Yes, exactly. And that's that might be something to consider. You know, if it was zoned for a McDonald's, you know, over a decade ago, I mean, that's, you know, we have more people now. We have more cars out there than there were over a decade ago. It's seems like a different discussion now. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see if it succeeds.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that's interesting about that, you know, you talk about the traffic, is that the reason that they're putting this entrance in the subdivision on that street going into the subdivision is because the main road can't accommodate that additional traffic. And it's basically, you know, it's near First Coast High School, right across the street, busy Duval Station Road. It is not able to withstand, you know, having a drive through hanging out onto those traffic lanes. And so this is the alternative, is to go inside the subdivision.
Yeah. And you know, I understand people's frustration. You know, you don't want your backyard smelling like chicken and, you know,
unless
all that traffic. Yeah. Unless it's for your dinner in your kitchen.
Yeah. This is, you know, a quality of life thing, Megan, but there's also been some research recently that has linked the presence of retail, fast food restaurants, certainly things like bars and pawn shops and liquor stores, to an increase in crime. And so some residents have pointed that out as a real concern that they have, that this will not just be traffic and smelling like chicken, but also possibly a magnet for crime, for criminal activity.
I can absolutely understand the residents' concerns. And like Will mentioned a minute ago, I hope that they exercise the right to vote with the upcoming elections.
Yeah. Charlie McGee, I want to talk about some... Oh, go ahead, Will.
Oh, no, I was going to say that it's worth mentioning that, you know, First Coast High School, like we all said, it's right across the street. In 2019, a student was killed in a crosswalk right near First Coast High School. And in the 2022-23 academic year, there are two students who are hitting a crosswalk at First Coast High School. So this isn't like residents just, you know, talking out of thin air. And lastly, it's also worth noting that this week when the governor signed his budget, he vetoed $500,000 for a crosswalk at First Coast High School. Those are all things worth noting as we note a business that's going to come and that's going to bring in a lot of additional vehicular traffic.
I want to talk about some reporting, Charlie, that you've been doing into the use of algorithms in rental units. This is the subject of a federal civil rights lawsuit alleging racial discrimination. Bring us up to speed on what the allegations are in this civil case and what happened just this last week.
Yeah, so the whole impetus for kind of my looking into this issue is a lawsuit that was filed at the U.S. District Court here in Jacksonville by the attorneys from Jacksonville Area Legal Aid. They're representing a few Jacksonville residents, I think four in specific by name, who have had similar experiences with a corporate landlord, as you might call it, that a lot of people in Jacksonville are familiar with, JWB, acronym for Jacksonville Wealth Builders. They're one of Northeast Florida's biggest landlords in terms of just sheer properties managed. And the focus of the lawsuit is basically what's called tenant screening services. And so this is a sort of sub-industry of background checking software that landlords throughout the country, a lot of them use, and more in recent years as the technology has sort of gotten, more expansive. But essentially, it's, you know, if you apply to rent from JWB, they sort of automatically run your name, your information through one of these tenant screening providers. And that's where the algorithm comes in. It's this sort of automated software that's just combs through as many court filings that exist on any record out there to try and identify anything that might be a red flag in relation to you as a tenant and whether you might be a risky person to rent out to. And one of the issues is that this technology is not perfect, which is often the case with algorithms and technology, is there's a lot of mismatched names that can occur. So let's say your name's John Smith. You might get mismatched with some other guy named John Smith who maybe has a felony conviction, or in this case, what the focus is eviction filings. And so JWB, according to the lawsuit, has a sort of blanket policy where if there is any finding that you've had an eviction filing against you in the past 5 years, you're automatically disqualified from potentially being approved for a rental with JWB. And so it's, according to the lawsuit, you know, even in cases where people have proven, hey, you mismatched my name, I've never faced an eviction filing in my life, JWB will still say, well, no, you're disqualified anyways.
And it's worth noting that it's not free to make an application to live in one of these residences. There's a significant fee that's not refundable.
Yeah, non-refundable. I think it's right now it's $80 for an individual trying to applying to rent. And if it's a multiple person household, it'll be up to $160 just to apply. And if you, again, get mismatched by one of these algorithms, get disqualified, you can't get that fee back. And that's one of the things that this lawsuit is seeking as relief, is they want all of those non-refundable fees to be refunded by JWB. And the specific focus, sort of what makes this lawsuit unique, is it's a civil rights lawsuit. It's grounded in the Fair Housing Act. And that's actually a novel legal argument that hasn't really been tested, as far as I can tell, according to the lawyers, there's no really legal precedent on this specific issue of the argument basically is on top of how unfair it is, maybe, if you get disqualified from an application because someone else had a filing against them. The argument also is Black Americans, and both at the local level and just throughout the country for years, have disproportionately been the subject of eviction filings, and that includes maybe a bogus eviction filing. Maybe you have like a vindictive landlord a few years ago who just filed for eviction. Maybe you beat it in court, but you still have a filing on your record that can be found by one of these algorithms. And so the argument is JWB is essentially discriminating against black renters or black prospective renters by, you know, preemptively almost, you know, sort of setting up illegal barriers for them potentially being able to access housing. And that's why the lawsuit, they're seeking to represent a class, make it a class action, and the judge hasn't ruled yet to certify that or not. But if the judge certifies the class that they want, they would basically be representing every black rental applicant who has been rejected by JWB based on an eviction filing that didn't actually lead to an eviction in the last few years.
And tell us, what has JWB said about this? They asked the judge to dismiss it, but what have they been saying publicly?
Not much, you know, as is often the case when, you know, you're the subject of this kind of lawsuit, you don't want to talk, you know, about pending litigation. And so they've declined to sort of comment in much detail, except Alex Safakis, who runs JWB, essentially, he did comment to me late last year that we vehemently deny any allegations of discrimination. And, you know, the argument that they're sort of making thus far is that these plaintiffs are going to have to prove that, you know, that JWB has disproportionately rented out properties to non-black residents in areas where, you know, maybe the black population is higher than the amount of black renters they're approving. And so it'll be interesting to see. I think there's a lot of sort of legal argumentation that hasn't happened yet. That will be really interesting to see sort of at trial, to see how it develops.
And I guess in their legal filings, or at least in your reporting, it's made clear that one of their claims is that, you know, that it would be difficult to prove any discriminatory intent because most of their properties, or a large portion of their properties, are in predominantly black neighborhoods. And they're saying there would be no evidence of us being discriminatory because we are primarily renting to black families.
Right. Well, and important point is that the plaintiffs are not arguing discriminatory intent. They're actually arguing a discriminatory effect. So it's kind of a technical thing, but like under the Fair Housing Act, someone like, say, JWB could be held liable for either of those things. And so what they're arguing is, hey, JWB might not even be intending to discriminate. They might not, you know, that might not be their goal, but just the effect inherently of this policy is discrimination. And, you know, yeah, again, it'll be that's why, because, yeah, the sort of basis of the civil rights claim is, number one, that black Americans, you know, disproportionately have always faced eviction filings more than other people. And as you say, that most of JWB's properties are located in sort of slivers of Duval County that have a higher black population than sort of the county as a whole. And so JWB is arguing, hey, if you want to prove that we're discriminating here, you have to prove that in these areas we are renting out properties to more non-black residents than black residents.
It's interesting. We did a segment earlier this week about how Duval County actually leads the state in eviction filings, almost double other major metro areas. We also talked in that discussion about the use of algorithms in renting. We spoke to the researcher on this study, Caitlin Renzi. Let's hear a little bit about what she had to say.
In the case like Jacksonville, where probably 50% of overall apartment complexes are using this algorithm, it creates a situation where the algorithm is comparing rents that are set by the algorithm to other apartment complexes that also have rents set by the algorithm. And so it's almost like this, you know, price fixing.
So it's interesting, Will, we're living in the age of the algorithm. I think it's probably supplanting free will in many, many ways in terms of how it directs everything that we do and everything we experience. But if it's creating artificially high rents, and this is the subject of an investigation by the Department of Justice.
And I can say that when I drive around, whether it's taking my son to school or it's in the reporting that I do, I consistently see JWB signs for rent. I think one time I saw a 3-bedroom, 1-bathroom home on 13th Street for rent for like $1,300. I'm like, wait a minute, what's going on here? Which is one of the poorest zip codes in the state. It was a wild thing to see considering the high price of rents for properties in some of these very highly impoverished neighborhoods.
Got a call from Councilwoman Tyrona Clark Murray. Good morning to the District 9 council member. Go ahead.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Well, how are you?
I'm doing just fine. I had wanted to, when you were talking about the Chick-fil-A bill, I wanted to make a comment in regards to the, first of all, it should not have passed. And unfortunately, we didn't have the votes to quash it. But just some other aspects in regards to the owner wanting to put a Chick-fil-A there. There are some conditions that were put in the bill so that he has to help mitigate the traffic before they can actually open the restaurant. And that traffic mitigation is creating building a traffic signal on the main road so that to help in regards to the traffic. The other aspect I wanted to talk about was the footprint. So as it was mentioned by, I think, either you or one of your guests, that previously McDonald's wanted to put a restaurant there. And I think in their study, they also determined that they would have to at some point may have queuing on the residential road. And so I think that's one of the reasons why they did not build there. And that was back in 2015. And so unfortunately, Chick-fil-A it's been approved for them to build their restaurant, but there are some conditions that they must meet prior to actually opening. And as I mentioned on Tuesday night, traffic signals cost anywhere from about $700,000 to maybe a little north of $1 million. And that doesn't include all of the other aspects that the owner of this particular Chick-fil-A will need to pay. So hopefully those are some of the impediments that will actually prevent them from actually building. That's what I wanted to let the audience know.
Thank you, Councilmember. Appreciate your input. We are only going to have just a little minute here to talk about Jacksonville's ranking, kind of won or rather lost in this Forbes list of the worst cities for summer travel. It was unveiled this week, and it's hard to be number one on that list. I mean, the out of every place in the United States, really?
I mean, yeah, I kind of don't pay too much attention to rankings. I mean, you know, is it taking into account the charming people here? I mean, there's lots of intangibles, I think, that you can't quantify. So, I mean, I kind of take that with a grain of salt. But the heat is oppressive right now.
That's a fact. Megan, do people take these lists seriously?
I think sometimes people do. I tend to also take them with a grain of salt because I would want to know more about the methodology behind it as a data nerd. But I think that it does make for a good or a bad headline, depending on which side you end up on.
Yeah, well, probably not great for the city's tourism at this moment. But Charlie McGee, Megan Malicote, and Maxwell Will Brown, thank you all so much for being here and for a great discussion.
Thank you.
Up next, a documentary celebrating local film history premieres at Sunray Cinema just days before the local theater closes for good.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Serious injury cases are complex, and civil trial attorneys present the evidence juries need to see and hear. More at waynehogan.law.
North Florida TPO, proud sponsor of WJCT's First Coast Connect, bringing to the community innovation in transportation planning, commuter services, clean fuels, and intelligent transportation systems. More at northfloridatpo.com.
Hi, this is Tom Hudson. Every Friday on the Florida Roundup, you can expect discussion, not disinformation.
Hi there, I'm a family therapist.
This is a First Amendment violation.
Revelations, not empty rhetoric.
Today I just found out that I was eligible for $23 a month in food stamps.
And even some surprises.
Dr. Brown, you helped deliver my baby, and I owe you my life.
Wow.
It's the Florida Roundup, Fridays at noon.
This week on Science Friday, protecting fireflies, that symbol of warm summer nights.
We are looking at fireflies as sort of a charismatic species that folks care about. Studying fireflies can tell us more about how to manage habitats for insects in general.
That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
The House of Representatives is holding the Attorney General in contempt. Justice Samuel Alito is in the headlines again, this time in secret recordings where he says only one side and not compromise can win the culture war. And the president's son has been convicted of 3 felonies, a first for this country. It's the domestic edition of the Friday News Roundup. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, Jacksonville has had a long and complicated courtship with the film industry. Once beloved by filmmakers, the city endured a bitter breakup that's lasted about 100 years. And it's a story that filmmaker Royce Freeman tries to capture and update in his new documentary, First Coast Cinema, a Jacksonville documentary. Royce, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Why did you want to tell this story?
I am a filmmaker. It's actually a family business. My dad's a filmmaker, and I grew up in New York, and I watched him do film growing up. And when I moved to Jacksonville in Orange Park, Jacksonville in 2004, I started to get into the film scene, and I became aware of this rich history. And over the years, I went to many showcases, the 48-Hour Film Project, LOL, lots of different things, and I started to realize that there's all these different subcultures and cliques, and there's a groundswell of trying to recapture what once was, but lightning in a bottle is something that you can't recapture. But it seems like we're trying to blaze our own trail, you know, and make a new mark.
Mm-hmm. So for people who aren't familiar with Jacksonville's history as kind of the original Hollywood, I guess some people will say it was the winter film capital for a period because of the temperate climate, and it was very receptive for a minute. That changed.
Oh yeah, I mean, the winter. You know, there was film in Chicago and New York and New Jersey, and then it came down to Jacksonville. They started in all these studios that were in like Springfield area, Arlington. It was actually called Arlington, Florida. It wasn't called Jacksonville at that point. And you know, filmmakers like Oliver Hardy and there was just all this going on back in the early 1900s. And you know, you do this documentary, you start to hear all the juicy little details. And apparently, in the South, they didn't like people working on Sundays. And they also didn't like that if you wanted a fire truck in your movie, you set a fire to a building and you roll the camera and then, you know, you're filming the fire and the fire truck. So they didn't like all that, you know, the shenanigans. So they sent them packing. And
you mean sort of the city fathers didn't like this Hollywood element?
Oh, well, yeah, because there was no Hollywood. There was no Hollywood in California. And did you know that in California, palm trees are not indigenous to California? When the filmmakers left Jacksonville, they took their palm trees with them.
Is that right?
Yeah, and they just went to California with their palm trees.
Isn't that funny, because you associate them so closely. There were stories like that of filmmakers, you know, calling in fake fires just to get the footage of these fire trucks roaring by. There was also, I think, this sense that this was a really hedonistic element that some conservative city leaders did not enjoy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, there was the, you know, they had their parties and like the roaring 20s kind of thing. And they just, you know, in the South, you know, and they didn't like it.
So your film brings us to the present and explores some of these, as you call them, cliques that kind of have developed a thriving but small movie you know, scene in local one. So who did you choose to focus on?
Well, when I first started doing the documentary, I had a core group of people that I was just going to interview because it was my own circle of knowledge. There's a guy, Richard Kodai, and he's a filmmaker in St. Augustine, and he did in 2014-15 this thing called the Short Film Showcase at Sunray Cinema, and he was doing that for many years, and that's how I met a lot of filmmakers here in this town. And then, you know, at some point, that showcase kind of soft shifted over to Adam and Monique Madrid, and they opened the LOL Jacks, and then they took over the 48-hour film project in Jacksonville. And so they were going to be the focus. But then I learned a interesting piece of information that, shame on me that I should have known it when I moved here. There was a guy named Richard Norman, and he was a Caucasian filmmaker in the early 1900s. And he decided to do a bunch of African-American films where he was going to be showcasing African-Americans in positive light, where they were doctors and lawyers and pilots and not, you know, stereotypical roles that were demeaning. And so he was this trailblazer and paved the way. And I learned about this guy, Chad Hendricks, who was doing stuff. He was in Folio Weekly in the early 2000s. They called him the Eminem of Jacksonville. And he does the same kind of thing, but with rappers and zombies and all kinds of stuff. And he has actually been called the Richard Norman of the modern era because all the filmmakers I interviewed said that he kind of started a movement too.
So this screens at Sunray Cinema on July 2nd. It's just a few days before that theater closes its doors. It must be a very kind of bittersweet premiere.
Every film I've made, feature film, has premiered at Sunray Cinema, and it's a homecoming. You know, the theater is owned by Tim and Shayna Messett, and they're really, really positive forces in the film community. They're so they open their doors to filmmakers. They're very reasonable with the rates and stuff.
Well, I hope that the screening is a success. Thank you so much, Royce, for being on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me.
And that's our program. We encourage your feedback. You can send it to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Join us Monday. We're going to be doing a segment on 40 Acres and a Lie. We discuss a recent investigation that tracks down the living descendants of that broken promise. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.